So, all right. So, what do we got to talk about today? Deploying and updating Microsoft Office 365 Pro Plus, or Click to Run, as you probably hear it called quite often. So, the thing about this session is that we're getting to the point. It's now been a year since the new version of Office became available and the new deployment mechanism for Office became publicly available. And I'm in a position where I've presented this content quite a few times. I've presented it to this kind of an audience, and I've presented the deployment session to a bunch of organizations around the country and worked on a bunch of those large-scale deployments as well. And the challenge that I have this year around is that I could get up here and I could get my 50-slide deck out and I could go through one bit at a time and explain all the different components of how Click to Run works, what Click to Run is, and I probably should do that. But at the end of the day, every room that I talk to is different. And so it strikes me as a far more appropriate thing to do to try and engage with you guys and understand what information is relevant to you about Office 365 Pro Plus and how we can take the new tools that have been made available to us and use them to best advantage in our organizations that we're working for, or our customers, partners, whatever. So in order to do that, I need to ask you some questions. So tell me, around the room, hands up if you work for some kind of government or large enterprise organization. Okay, so that's about half the room. So of you people who just put your hands up, tell me, how many of you are currently running Office 2013 across your fleet? Nobody. Okay, oh, one guy. All right, how many PCs you got? Sorry?
Not many.
Not many, right, okay. So anyone from that group running Office 2010 across the board? That looks like most of you. So it seems like we're in a position now where our enterprise and government participants in this room have deployed Office 2010. So at least you're reasonably current. So anyone on older than that, 2007? Three or four guys. 2003? Three people. Anyone on older than 2003, predominantly across your fleet? All right. So it seems like we've got a little bit of 2003, a little bit of 2007, and a whole lot of 2010. So the rest of you that are in the room, where are you guys from? Are you from partner organizations? Seems to be the way. We've got a couple of Office 365 partners in the room. And so you guys would be going out, you'd be talking to your customers, and you'd be talking to them about Office and about Office 365 and helping them deploy. So it seems like the next logical thing for me to do is to explain to you what the difference is between Office 365 Pro Plus and Office 2013. Can anyone tell me in one sentence the difference between Office 365 Pro Plus and Office 2013? Yes? That is a correct answer. One is licensed per user and one is licensed per machine. Anyone else can tell me? Sorry? One is via subscription and the other one is available by? Volume licensing is the correct answer. So, here we go. So, Office 2013, we said, let me just turn my ink on. If it would let me turn my ink on. User-based. No, I have that totally wrong. There we go. And device-based. And we said that Office 365 Pro Plus is via subscription, and Office 2013 is volume licensed. Can anyone tell me another difference between Office 365 Pro Plus and Office 2013? Yes, up the back. One is a full client. Yep, yep, an MSI-based install. And the other one is? Absolutely correct. So, Office 2013 is available only as an MSI or traditional base deployment, and Office 365 Pro Plus is streamed. And as we'll see later on in the session, it's fairly critical to understand that it's streamed not only available from the Office 365 service, from the content delivery network, but also from a local source that you might have installed on your machine as well. Anyone else got any ideas as to how they differ? No? Yes, up the back. Office 2013 cannot be packaged using AppV as opposed to Office 365 Pro Plus, which? It doesn't quite come as AppV. It is, so Office 365 Pro Plus is based on AppV technology, but it isn't quite an AppV package natively, but you can make one. So that's a really, really, really good point. So we can say AppV based. Does anyone in the room know what AppV is? Yeah? Lots of nods. And then that's also still MSI-based. So I think that gives us a pretty good idea as to what the differences are between Office 365 Pro Plus and Office 2013. And so you see, I'm going to jump all over slides here because I just have some stuff to draw on, really. Like I said, I'm looking to you guys to tell me what information you need to give me out of this session and hopefully make it as interactive as possible. So that's all fine. We know how they're different. So what is Office 365 Pro Plus? Office 365 Pro Plus is very, very, very clearly, let me be very clear about this as the first thing that I want you to take away, is that Office 365 Pro Plus, even though it has the words Office 365 in it, and that is a cloud-based service, Office 365 Pro Plus is a fully featured copy of the Office client. Fully featured. There is not one feature today that is available in Office 2013, the MSI volume license build, that you cannot get in Office 365 Pro Plus. So how are they different? Well, we've just said the ways that they're different. Office 365 Pro Plus is a user-based licensing model. So if you are licensed through Office 365, then you would be able to, and within your rights to, install Office 365 Pro Plus on 5 computers for every user that you have in your organization. Whereas with Office 2013, the only vehicle to buy that these days is through volume licensing, which means that you'd be on device-based licensing for every device, PC, Mac, whatever you have in your organization, you would need a license for Office. So that's the first difference. The second thing to understand is that the mechanism for actually deploying the Office bits onto the machines is different, and that is the critical thing to understand. All the features, once Office is on the machine, I can put a copy of Office 2013 on a Windows 8 PC and a copy of Office 365 Pro Plus. No one in this room is going to be able to tell the difference. Well, actually, that's not true. You're all intelligent people. You could go into programs and features and have a look at which version was installed. But apart from that, there's no tangible difference when you're interacting with the Office applications as to which one you're using. The difference is how they get from where they start, be that the content delivery network, be that a local share that you have, a file server, a web server, or some kind of software deployment mechanism like SCCM or whatever. That is where we differ. So we have a new AppV-based deployment technology that allows us to stream the Office client down onto the machines in a fairly dynamic manner. And why is this important? I'd be really keen to hear in the room if you guys have challenges that you're facing at the moment with your Office deployment that might be impacted by this change in the deployment technology. Does anyone have anything that they think would be relevant? Yes. So the question was, can a non-privileged user install the products using Office 365 Pro Plus? The answer to that question is, on an academic level, no. A non-privileged user cannot install software inside the C program files directory on a PC. In most cases where you have non-privileged users, they would be going to some kind of software portal or something like that. So say you had SCCM inside your organization, you could send them to a software portal, they could click on an install, but the install would actually be initiated by the system account, by the SCCM client, which runs with the system account, so it wouldn't really become relevant. Does that answer the question?
Well, the background is I'm going to have 30 years in a remote site, so
Mm.
There's no desktop support there.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So updated is not a problem. As you'll see, hopefully later on in the session, we'll get into a bit of a discussion about how the updates work, and we can draw that up and have a look at that. But certainly for the, so because those updates will happen of their own accord, you won't need an administrator to do that part of the process. But to do the initial install, yes, you will need administrative rights, or you will need some kind of deployment mechanism that will give you those administrative rights, such as SCCM, or you could use MDT or something to that effect. Okay? So taking a step back for a second, let's try and put a little bit of context around why it is important that we change the deployment mechanism for Office. The deployment mechanism for Office has been in place and has been unchanged for quite a while. Can anyone tell me which version of Office first used MSIs? No one? All right. The answer was Office 2000. So the MSI package type was actually built for Office 2000 and then later pinched by the, I mean, given very politely from the Office team to the Windows team to use, and it is now the standard for deploying software across applications. So it's something that's been in place and it's been used to deploy Office for quite an amount of time. But something changed. And in my mind, what changed is the cadence for release of new Office Division products. So when I say Office Division products, I'm talking specifically about all the Office 365 workloads, Exchange, SharePoint, Link, and the Office client itself. So in the past, this hasn't been too much of a challenge. Organizations move fairly slowly through these workloads. When a large deployment of Exchange or SharePoint takes place, normally an organization won't change that deployment to a new version very quickly. So if we need to line up, okay, we're going to deploy Exchange 2007, in order to take advantage of all these new features, we need to install Office 2007, so we get Outlook 2007. That was something that could be managed. So, okay, part of our project to roll out Exchange 2007 or 2010 or whatever it is, will be to roll out the Office client that goes with that. And that's manageable. That might be something that happens every 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years. And okay, no problems. But something shifted now. With Office 365, we're in a position where these services are having features added to them at a much more rapid cadence. So instead of having a new version of Exchange or whatever shipped once every 3 years, we've got updates coming through once every 3 months. So what does that mean then if we were to stay with the old deployment capabilities and methodologies for the Office client? We would no longer be in a position where we could easily deploy new builds of Office out to our end users so that they could take advantages, so that they could take advantage of the new features that that were made available inside the server-side workloads. So I give you an example. There's some new search capabilities that are implemented into Exchange. In order to take advantage of those, we need to put a new build of Outlook onto the machine. But how do we do that when we've got 1 or 2 gigabytes worth of content to deploy a new version of Office down onto 5, 10, 15, 20, 100,000 PCs? So that, for me, is the context around where that the need for this change has come from. And if you're thinking about, hey, do I want to be deploying Office 2013 or do I want to be deploying Office 365 Pro Plus, I feel as though that's where your thoughts should eventually lead you. It's because if you've invested in those other workloads and moving them online to Office 365, then it stands to reason and it's a logical conclusion that you need to invest in the new deployment capabilities for the Office client so that you can keep those versions synced up relatively so that you don't have these big mismatches in client versions where 3 years go by, you've got all this new functionality inside Office 365 that your organizations or your customers' organizations have paid for and have invested in, and that you now can't take advantage of. Does that make sense to everyone? Are you seeing this trend starting to emerge with your customers that are moving to Office 365? I'm sure this gentleman here has seen that a few times.
Mm-hmm. How they get to sort of E1 and E3 type licensing.
Right. And so that certainly makes up part of that challenge, is that large organizations who have been traditionally been on volume license agreements, and we run the fine line of getting into a licensing discussion here, which obviously we don't want to do, but large organizations that have traditionally been on VL are now moving to subscription-based models with E1 and more specifically to this conversation, E3 Office 365 licenses, and how do we make sure that those people are able to take advantage of that change in licensing and the investment that they've made in remaining current with these services. So that's, of course, not to say that those are the only problems that we were looking to solve with the Office 365 Pro Plus, the click-to-run technology. There's another really critical piece of the puzzle that factored in right about the 2007 and more in the 2010 timeframe. And it was driven out of this really big shift that happened between Office, and this is only my opinion, obviously, but I feel as though this need drove out of the change between Office 2003 and Office 2007. Anyone tell me what, have a guess at what changed between those versions that made all the difference? XML file format, right? So every other version that's come before, there's been a fairly high degree of comfort that, with the exception of a few of our more perplexing parts of the Office suite that might have Maroon logos, and we won't name them, of course, because they're fantastic and we love them and we all like making databases. But for the most part, if I made a Word document inside Office 97, then I should be fairly confident that I can open it up in Office 2003 or Office 2000, and that'll work just fine. But this big shift happened with the OpenXML file format that it created this mass hysteria and this high level of fear, uncertainty, and doubt about the ability of the Office client, the new Office 2007 client, to open old file formats. Some would say that's founded, some would say that's not founded. But what we found was a lot of large organizations, and I think especially a lot of large organizations I've seen in the financial services industry, Mr. Ferguson, do you agree with me, have found that there's a lot of fear that's come along with moving to those new versions because of the change in file format and because of the implementation of the ribbon UI. So there was concerns that end users would lose productivity and they wouldn't be able to keep functioning in the way that they used to because they used to have some drop-down menus, now they have some tab-looking things, and how could they possibly ever figure that out? Well, guess what they have. So, excuse me. Back during that time frame, one very popular solution to both of these challenges that we spoke to was to take Office 2010 or Office 2007, but more predominantly Office 2010, and package it up with AppV streaming technology. And this is a great idea, because what it means is we can encapsulate this Office install inside its own little virtual bubble, and it would allow us to stream it down to our end users in a very dynamic fashion. And then better yet, we wouldn't have to uninstall the old version of Office, because this AppV bubble would keep it contained from the old version and allow us to run side-by-side versions of Office on the same machine. So the idea behind this is really smart, right? Okay, here's what we'll do. You know, we're not sure how many of our users will adapt to the new user interface and the new features quickly, so we'll leave the old version installed, and if they happen to have some trouble using the new version, then we can say to them, that's fine, you can just go ahead and use the old version until you become accustomed, or say you had a file or an add-in or a plugin or something like that that didn't work properly, then you could keep using that old version until the IT organization either had the opportunity to re-educate you or to fix whatever problem was preventing you from using that file in the first place. Makes sense? Great idea. Fantastic. And we did this out at a whole bunch of organizations, and a lot of them in the financial services industry, simply because that industry has a very low risk profile that they're willing to accept when it comes to Office documents. So we did that. And it was something that was so in such high demand, challenging that it was to implement, it was in such high demand that that functionality and those capabilities have been core in the way that we've spec'd and built out the Office 365 Pro Plus deployment mechanism since then. So what's changed between, and I think I actually have a slide up here if you'll, oh yes I do, and it's the next one. So this will let me kind of talk to you about the difference between the two. So over on this side is our Office 2010 package that was built with AppV. So all, I'm just going to change this color because you're not going to be able to see anything otherwise. All sequenced up inside its own little virtual bubble, and then we stream it down onto the machine, we point the file associations at it, and hey presto. So we can control which version of Office happens based on which file associations we send where, and that's fantastic. Did anyone implement this approach at their organization or another organization? Yeah? I'd be really keen if you could, I'd be really keen to hear what challenges you faced when doing that. Yeah?
So Office 2010 with AppV at the client site we had, there was a couple of issues with app compat for the add-ins.
Mm-hmm.
So having to package the or sequence the add-ins.
Mm-hmm. Inside the bubble.
Yeah, yeah. And then also had some issues with Project and Visio interacting with Outlook.
Yep. So for basic, normal, you know, document editing and everything, really good. But you've called out it's the exact same experiences that we had. We have this virtualized bubble here, and say we have another add-in or plug-in or another piece of software that interacts with Office in some way. It's outside this bubble, and it can't talk. So we need to either sequence it inside the Office package that we sequenced up, and this can be quite a lengthy and complicated process, or we sequence it separately and then we use something called dynamic suite composition to say, okay, this bubble can talk to this bubble but not that bubble, and then there are just bubbles going everywhere and it gets out of hand. So how does that differ? And it's really, I'm really keen to get this point across to you as to how that differs from the AppV base technology that Office 365 Pro Plus is based on. And the main difference is that we use something called just-in-time virtualization. And you'll see that there is no square here. And the reason that there is no square here on that slide is because with a click-to-run install, even though it's based on the AppV technology, we have a much looser bubble than you did with that Office 2010 and AppV scenario. And what that means is that any add-in or plug-in or any other piece of code that's running on the system should still be able to interact with the Office applications in the same way as if it was an MSI-based Office 2013 install. And that's really good news. And the data that I have to back that up is that more than a year after the launch of Office 365 Pro Plus, as it stands today, Microsoft support are yet to, or sorry, the engineering team is yet to accept a bug for an add-in or plug-in which works correctly with Office 2013 MSI and doesn't work with Office 365 Pro Plus. So now before everyone starts drooling over the fact that I've just told you that every add-in and plug-in in the world works with Office 365 Pro Plus, if you'd listen carefully, you will know that I didn't say that. The point that I'm trying to get across with is that if it's compatible with Office 2013 in the MSI build, it will be compatible and it will be able to interact correctly with Office 365 Pro Plus. So you will still need to remediate your add-ins and plug-ins if they don't function with the latest version, with the Office 2013 version. But if they do, then you're going to find that they're going to work either way. And that's really exciting for us because it means anything that's using MAPI COM add-in stuff, the Office COM APIs, all of that stuff is able to be used correctly with both inside both of those scenarios. So, okay. That kind of speaks to how the virtualization layer itself hangs together. We've spoken about how the identity, we've spoken about how the user activation licensing model hangs together, user-based versus device-based. We've spoken about the feature parity between the two. Let's just talk for a minute about how it differs to manage the two different types of clients. And I think I have a bit of a blank slide here that we can use. So, all right. So, in terms of management, there's a few things that are the same across the board. And they are, they are bumping the screen. Group policy is used to manage both Office 365 Pro Plus installations and Office 2013 installations. What's more than that, the same group policy ADMX templates apply to both. So there are a couple of settings inside those ADMX templates that are specific to the Office 365 Pro Plus install type. However, they're contained inside the same ADMX files, and we use them to manage both at the same time. So, okay, so group policy is the same. We'll also find that all the actual product features are the same. And we will find that the Office 365, obviously the deployment method is different. So for Office 365 Pro Plus, we know that it's streamed. And we have MSI over here. When we're deploying the Office 2013 clients, the same tools are used to actually do the hands-on or hands-off deployment of Office 2013 as the previous version. Can anyone tell me what those three configuration tools are? No one. Hang on, do I have prizes to give away? Oh my guys, I saw them walk in with... I have 15 Blackwire 310s. That's awesome. Who wants a Plantronics Blackwire 310? That's pretty cool. That's a cool prize. All right. Well, if you want one, then you can tell me one of the three tools that are used to deploy Office 2013. Yes? Sorry, one at a time. You there, sir? Sorry, one of the tools that's used to configure Office 2013 clients. Yes, sir? Setup.exe is one of the tools that is used to configure the Office. So, okay, fine, there's four then. I'm going to have to give you that one. So this gentleman here is going to, you beauty. Thank you, Mr. Watkins. Are you going to be my Blackwire distributor?
I can do that.
Thank you, sir. All right, anyone else got a guess as to what one of the deployment configuration tools is? The gentleman up the back.
The Transform.
Yep, I'm looking for the tool that's used to create that. I'll give you another go at it. The gentleman next to him? No, not correct. Yes, you sir, in the white shirt? Oh, almost, but not correct. Yes, sir? The Office customization tool is correct. Thank you very much. There we go. All right, so we have the setup.exe. We have the Office customization tool, which is used to create those MSP files. And there is two more configuration tools that we use to actually change how the install and operational behavior of Office works. Yes, sir. Config file, that is correct. That's the gentleman in the gray shirt with his hand up there. So the config.xml file is correct. And the last one, I already have it on the board. Group policy, who said that? The gentleman up there in the red shirt. Up here in the back. All right, guys, so that's really cool. So let's talk about how that differs from Office 365 Pro Plus configuration methods. It's almost the same. Group policy is still used for both to configure what the applications should look like when they're on the machine. So whether that's what a default should be set at or some kind of security setting that should be locked down, we still use the group policy ADMX templates to configure those. We also use a setup.exe file. The setup.exe file is now a separate download that's made available as part of the Office Deployment Tool, or ODT. So unlike the previous versions where you use the setup.exe/admin switch to configure those, we now have a separate tool that can be downloaded to configure and install Office on client machines. And I can actually show you what that looks like because it seems to be a logical time to do so. Give me a moment. Cool. not the right machine. So what I'm going to show you in just a second is the Office deployment tool. I've downloaded it here, and I'm going to show you how that is used and what the different configuration tools inside it are that you can use to download and deploy the Office bits for yourself. All right, this should work all right. All right, so what you're looking at is the Office customization tool. This is a bit of an old version, but it's roughly the same. So what you end up with is two things. You end up with a setup.exe file, and you end up with a config.xml file that you need to use. So let me open up the default config.xml file that looks roughly like this. Can everyone see that okay? Yes? Is it too small? Should I zoom in? All right, there we go. So what we're looking at here is the default configuration file that's used to do two things. Either download Office 365 Pro Plus builds to then be later staged on your local file share or your deployment tool, and to actually install those builds that you either downloaded locally or that you're going to stream live from the content delivery network onto your machine, your end users' computers. So how does this hang together? The first section that we have here is not going to let me edit it. I know why. It doesn't matter. I can just talk you through it. So the first section here is the add section, and we either specify here or we don't specify the source path that we want to install from. So in the case that we're downloading Office bits, this source path parameter will determine where we save that Office build to on our local machine. And if we're installing Office onto end users' computers, this source path parameter will determine where we're going to install Office from. And what can that Office source path be? It can be either an SMB location or it can be an HTTP share. So either a web server or a file server, and it doesn't matter how that comes together or how it hangs together. Essentially, it sees them in the same way. So you might have a massive clustered web service that you want to use to deploy Office 365 Pro Plus bits out to internal and external users so that they're only getting the builds that you want. Or you might have a file server, a simple file server. You might be using DFS or distributed file system. Or you might be using a deployment tool such as SCCM to deploy those out. It doesn't matter. So long as we specify a source path in there, that's where it's going to install from. Once again here, we just said if we want 32 or 64-bit. Anyone done a Office 2010 64-bit deployment in a large-scale environment? You have. Jeez, how was that? How bad?
Yeah, pretty bad.
Why was it bad?
Because they specifically requested it even though we recommend they don't do it.
And right.
They realized during pilot that we were right.
And they realized that because none of their add-ins or plugins worked. Because who has ever written an add-in or plugin for Office 64-bit? I don't know very many myself. So if you head on down to the Office Productivity Showcase over the course of this week, or if you head to any of the other sessions, you'll find there's a bunch of people from the Office product team in Redmond who are here, and I guarantee you that every single one of them will tell you not to deploy the 64-bit of Office in a large-scale manner. It was built at this stage specifically for edge cases where the client on the machine needed to run massive Excel spreadsheets that exceeded the 2 gig memory allocation for a single application, even on a 64-bit machine. Anyway, moral of the story, 32-bit Office, please. The next section here is the product section, and this allows you to choose which parts of which Office 365 payloads you want to install onto the local machine, or in the case that you're downloading them, which payloads you want to download. So your options are Office 365 Pro Plus Retail, Visio Pro Retail, and also Project Pro. So those are the three workloads, the three client application suites that have been built with the click-to-run capabilities to date, and those are the ones that you can choose. After that, we have a section that allows us to either enable updates or disable them. And if we do enable them, it allows us to specify where we want to install them from. So that's really critical, because as you start to craft out these deployments, you'll understand that you've got a lot of flexibility in that you can actually choose a different location to deploy your updates from than the one that you're doing your base installs from. Now, why would anyone want to do that? Anyone got an idea off the top of their head? Yes. That is a really good point. So what the gentleman said is that maybe you don't want to worry about it, you just want to use the content delivery network. In a lot of cases, customers will get to a point where they say, you know what, we're happy enough to take the updates from the content delivery network as they become available. 5 years ago, no chance. Everyone would say, no, we need to do thorough testing on all of our patches in a serious lab of PCs before we go and do anything. So it's kind of gotten to a point now where the trust has been built up in a lot of cases, and organizations are more and more in a position where they will be more flexible about allowing updates to come through quickly. We'll talk about that a little bit more shortly. But what that does give us the ability to do, for example, is to say, okay, I'm going to download the build that I have today onto my local file server and then use that to do the big deployment out to all the machines that I have inside my network, but then I'm going to leave them to update from the content delivery network later. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to do any extra processes throughout the year. People can get their updates whether they're on my site or not on my site, and I'm happy with that, and that's great. But I'm still going to download the bits locally for the initial install. And it's worth understanding why that's important is because when we do the subsequent updates to this Office 365 Pro Plus build, they're done at a binary delta level. So if you are, already have a build, say you have 4454/1005, whatever it is, and the new build comes out, it might be the case that only 10 megabytes, say, of that Office build is actually different from the last one. So what does the Office client do? The update process itself, here's a blank slide. The update process looks at the build that is on the C drive, and it says, okay, I have all these files here. It looks at the build that is on the content delivery network, and we'll just write that there, content delivery network, and it says, okay, well, only this file, sorry? Oh, I'm on the wrong machine, aren't I? That wasn't very nice of me. My sincerest apologies. Okay, so there you go. So we've got all these files on our local drive here, and we've got the ones that are on the content delivery network, and we literally look at each file at a binary level and say which bits and bytes have changed. What's actually happened is that only this one here and only this one here have changed. So we download those files from the content delivery network or whichever file share or HTTP server we've got them staged on at a binary delta level. So how that differs from previous versions of Office, if you had MSP-style patches, you would actually need to download the whole patch, and that patch might have a whole bunch of different components in it because we might not know what patch level each machine it's being deployed to was at. So you might have one build, you might have a build that's a few earlier, and if I'm going to release a patch that's going to fix a certain problem, I might need to load extra binaries into that patch to make sure that anyone from a certain service pack and above can install it. So much more efficient now, and as we go along and as these implementations start to build, we should see a reduction in the amount of data that actually needs to move around the world in order for Office on a billion odd computers to be updated. So I think, does that give everyone a good idea? Does anyone have any questions about how the update process hangs together and how the how those updates actually happen? Yes, that's a really good question. So the question was, can you roll back the version of the build of Office, which is on the server that you're using to do the updates from? And the answer is yes. So the way that you would do that is that in this properties section here, you would set a force downgrade flag, and then you would simply put the build that you wanted to deploy on that file share. So if the build that you want to deploy is older than the build that's already on the machine will simply ignore it when it goes to do its updates. But if the build that you have is, if you have that force downgrade flag set, then it will say, okay, I see what's going on here. They actually want me to downgrade from a previous version to a previous build. So let's talk for a minute about how that process hangs together from an actual infrastructure point of view. And just give me a moment. I'll just try and pull up the right slide to let us do this. Oh, a bunch of my slides got deleted. That's not very nice. All right, this one should be able to work. So here's how it hangs together. Well, this slide's not going to work. I'm just going to make a blank one, and we'll build it up ourselves. So let's talk through how this works. We have the content delivery network up in the Office 365 service. And we download from that, on a regular basis or on a manual basis, our builds to our SMB server. From the SMB, and that could be HTTP as well, right? From there, we have our NPCs that are sitting out there in user land, and each of those looks to the SMB server and downloads new builds when they become available. How does it do that? Simply, there is a service that runs with the Office 365 Pro Plus build that looks every time you log on to the machine, once every Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday at a randomized time so that everyone isn't doing it at the same time. And it looks back to whatever was set in its configuration in the first place as its update location. When it looks there, it says, okay, is the build number the same as the build number that I have on my machine? If it is, it does nothing, no harm done. If it's not the same version, it says, okay, there's a new version that's suddenly become available, so I will now go and do a comparison of the hashes between these builds, and I'll download the bits and bytes that I need to download to make that work. So that's all well and good in some scenarios. But something that gets raised to me quite often is, well, hang on a second, we're one of these organizations that needs more control. We want to have something that's low fuss and low maintenance. We don't want to be sitting here with our big lab full of computers to do our genuine, very thorough testing on every patch that comes through every patch Tuesday. But they do want to have a bit more fault tolerance if something does come through from the Office 365 service that is incompatible with their environment for some reason or another. And that's a pretty easy thing to achieve as well. And here's how it works. Once again, we have our content delivery network, and once again, we have a scheduled task that's set up to download the builds onto our server. And in this case, this is going to be our dev server. Then we have maybe one or two, or maybe 10 or 20 PCs that are getting builds on a daily basis from that server. And that's fine. That might be our test group. A lot of organizations have set up patch test groups that get patches a month ahead of everybody else to see if there's any problems. And that scenario works just fine. And then all we would need to do in order to move that into the production environment is set up another production server and then have the rest of our PCs that are out there in user land getting their builds from that. Can anyone tell me what we would need to do at the end of that month to have the dev build that's going out to our test group go out to the rest of our production environment from there? Yes, sir. Right? It is as simple as that. All we need to do to move that from test into production is to copy the contents of the test SMB share into the prod SMB share. Simple as that. Now, you could even set that up to run on a scheduled task as well. So what we're starting to see a lot of organizations do is set something up that looks roughly like this, with one extra arrow drawn in it, which is that once every month, on a particular specified day, we copy the test into the prod. And so all you need to do then is just have a big red button that someone stops the scheduled task if something goes wrong, and you'd have a month to do that. So the downloads are scheduled to come down into your test server, and they do that by themselves. The updates go from your test server out to your test users. That happens by itself. After a month, if no one says boo, then they go from your test server into your prod server and then are disseminated out to all of your users. And what that means is that you still get that fault tolerance, that those patches aren't being pushed out to the general population straight away, but without having to go through the rigmarole of patching them time and time again as each of the patch Tuesdays rolls around in the first place. So, okay. So does anyone else have any questions about how the update process hangs together? Yes, sir.
Updates go from the content delivery network to your dev server in that scenario?
Yes. Yes. Can I explain it? So the question was, can I explain in a bit more detail how the updates get from the content delivery network and onto that SMB share? And I would love to do that. And I might even be able to give you a bit of an idea as to how that hangs together. Oh, and my machine went and rebooted itself because it needed to be patched. Give me a moment. We'll just revert it. Should work. Cool. So this is the same machine we were working on before, and we have our silent config file running right here. So what I've done here is I've said, okay, I want to download to C#Office 365 Pro Plus. I'm going to turn on updates and all that kind of stuff is going on. So this is a very, very basic configuration file that you might use to push builds out onto end users' PCs. But it can also be used to download the new builds from the content delivery network. And if I have, let's just see if we can do something like this. That looks like it might just work. Okay. See if my on-the-fly demo wants to work for us here. So the answer to your question, how those builds get from the content delivery network into your dev server, is this. You have some kind of scheduled task that runs setup.exe with a /download switch on it, and then we select the XML file that we want to use, and it's as simple as that. You see here, we just had an Office 365 Pro Plus folder created, and inside it, an Office folder, and inside it, a data folder. And then we have three things after that. We have a v32.cab file, a specific v32 file for the builds that are available inside that share, and then the contents of that build itself. So as more builds get downloaded into that same share, they just stack up folder after folder after folder. And in most cases, your end computers would use the most recent build that was inside that share. The only reason that that wouldn't happen is if you actually specify the version ID inside your XML file when you're doing the deployment, which you'd be more than welcome to do if you wanted to push specific builds out here or there. But I think the point that I'm trying to get to is that hopefully there's less and less and less of that going on as time goes on. So does that give you an idea of how those builds get down? It's really as simple as that. You get a spare file server that you've got lying around somewhere, and you set up a scheduled task on it that runs setup.exe with the download switch, and it will go off by itself and download those builds as they become available. You can run that same command every day if you want. If there's no build available, and if I can stall for a little bit longer here, then this build will finish downloading. Sorry for not being a good corporate citizen and downloading a gigabyte of stuff on the show network, but. If we let that finish downloading and then run the command again, it will still complete successfully. It'll just say, there's no new builds, and it'll exit out. So in the environments that I build, I tend to actually set up a scheduled task that runs that command every day at 3 o'clock in the morning. Who cares? If there's no new build there, it'll just exit out, and that's the end of the story. The first day that a new build becomes available, it will download that build, and then that build will become available in most cases to a test group. Yes, sir? Yep.
Can you change it
So the question was, if you build a config.xml file that causes updates to be turned on and to be set to get the updates from the CDN, then can you later go to those machines and change that update path to be something else, such as a local SMB or HTTP server? So the answer to the question is yes, there are two ways of doing it. If you want to do it the hard way, you can go and there's two registry keys that you can change. One that says update and updates enabled, and it's a one or a zero. It's just a binary value. And the other one is the update path. And so you can use whatever tool you like to set those registry keys manually. The easier way of going about it is just change the config file that you used to look how you want it to look, and then rerun setup. So when you rerun a setup.exe with the slash configure switch, which is the one that actually installs Office, then what happens is it looks for an existing Office 365 Pro Plus on the machine before it does anything. So if the same version that you are telling it to install is already installed, all it will do is look and say, is there anything different in these config files? And if the answer is that the update's got turned on or the update source path changed, then all it will do is change that registry key for you and exit out, no harm done. So does that answer that question? So that's a good lead into the last part about updates, which is what are the three ways that we can configure updates to work? Well, there's kind of four ways, but one's a combination of two other ones. The first option is that we set them up to run straight from the CDN and... Oh, sorry. Keep doing that, don't I? There we go. He didn't miss much. And that one kind of leaves us with not much control, but no work either. It's easy. We just send them to the CDN, and what they get. Happy days. So the way to do that is to set that updates path to equal true. The updates enabled to equal true, and then just have nothing in the update path, and then the setup.exe will assume that you want the CDN. The second option is the one that we just had drawn up on the whiteboard earlier, and that is to use an updates path. We want an updates path. It's capitalized like that. And that gives you control. But in a lot of cases, what I'm hearing from people is what that lacks is scalability. And what I mean by that is that if you have 200 sites of people out there and you don't have a DFS infrastructure in place or some kind of ability to move those Office builds out to somewhere local and appropriate for those machines, then that might not give you the scalability that you need to get your updates done efficiently. Now, in a lot of cases, if you have small sites, especially small sites with WAN accelerators, it makes a lot of sense to just put it on a web server somewhere and let it get cached by your WAN accelerators, considering that each time a build goes down, you don't necessarily need to pull that whole 1 gigabyte worth of build down to each site, because of that 1 gigabyte, it might only be 10 megabytes that each one of the PCs on that site will ever need. So if you just run it all from a centralized web server, in a lot of cases, that might be more efficient. You've only got one place to control it, one place to manage those builds from, and then use WAN acceleration or not to keep those processes running efficiently. But in some cases, that's just not going to work for people, and there is a third option. And let me explain to you what that third option is. I like to call it rerun setup. So the rerun setup method is the only one that we haven't explained yet. And in this method, what we basically do is when we do the initial Office 365 Pro Plus build, we specify that updates should be turned off completely. Mr. Office 365 update service, do nothing. Never try and update yourself from anywhere, ever, any, ever, 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 nothing. Then what we do is we rerun the setup.exe program with new builds as we want them to be pushed out. And as I described to you before, what happens when we rerun setup? We see that there's already a build on the machine. We check if the build that's on the machine is the same build that's specified in the setup.exe, or if it's the newest one on that location, and if it isn't, then we will update to the newest build from there, still at that binary delta level. So if you have staged distribution points inside an SCCM environment, for example, and you would prefer to have the control of running advertisements each time you want to do your updates, and that could take the form of mandatory or non-mandatory advertisements. It could take the form of a scheduled advertisement that reruns every month and you don't have to touch it. Whatever the scenario is, you do have the option of rerunning the setup.exe, and then the updates will only be installed when you tell them to using that method. Yes, sir. What happens to incomplete or corrupted installations? So corrupted installations are a bit of a funny one because the setup program will just download that file again if it's corrupted. Incomplete installations are heaps more of a non-event than you might think. So if a machine is interrupted in the middle of an update, or for that matter, an initial install of Office 365 Pro Plus, what'll happen is when the machine boots back up, the setup.exe process will start again. It will check what files were there, and it'll keep going. That simple. Cool? All right, guys, so I think we should have a pretty clear idea of how the updates and how the deployment of the Office 365 Pro Plus install type works. There's one big piece of the puzzle that I think we ought to talk about in the remaining, 15 minutes that we have left. And that is, nobody throw anything at me, identity. So let me put a bit of context around this. Traditionally, with Office builds, they were device activated, which made them a fairly straightforward thing to activate. We had MAC keys, multiple activation keys, and we had the key management services, which were volume licensed tools that would help organizations to activate their copies of Office with a small amount of fuss and give Microsoft some level of licensing compliance assurance in some form. Reduce piracy, all that good stuff. So that's all well and good when we have a device-based model, but with Office 365 Pro Plus, we've changed the licensing model to user-based, which means we need to change the activation model for user-based. So we're no longer solely concerned with what is the device that I'm installing Office on here. We now need to consider who is the user who is installing Office and what device are they installing it on, or more accurately, how many devices they're installing it on. Because as I said earlier, each user has 5 installs of Office that they can do. And that's a really cool and flexible piece of functionality that you can use in a whole bunch of organizations. Even if for nothing else then, giving end users the ability to install a fully licensed and fully functional copy of Office on their home PC, on their laptop that they bring in. Maybe they're a contractor or a consultant who has a BYO device or whatever. The point is that we now are in this position where we can let them install it on up to 5 devices, and they can manage that themselves in terms of activating and deactivating those installs of Office. But we need to consider what impact that has on how we activate Office and how the identity considerations fall into place as well. So, in terms of activating Office, we need to basically make sure that our users are inside our Office 365 tenant and have a Office 365 license assigned to them that includes Office 365 Pro Plus. Headsets to the 3 people who can tell me what 3 Office 365 SKUs have Office Pro Plus in them. Who said that? You are disqualified because you are the Office 365 SSP, and that would be highly inappropriate. Sorry? Close? Hangs in, someone already say E3? You said E3, so we have E3. Zach, do you want to chuck them up there? He's 3 for you. We have Office E3. What was the next one? Office M. I don't know what Office M SKU is. Sorry? I don't know which Office M SKU has Office 365 Pro Plus in it. Sorry, who said that? Up the back? Okay. Go for a run. No, there's one more. I'll give you a hint. It's written on the title slide up the back, sir. Sorry, just this gentleman up here. Nope, it's still an ESQ one technically. Oh, who said that? Now he's not owning up to it. You don't want a headset? Oh, up the back. There you go. So the answers are, after all of that, Office E3, Office E4, and Office 365 Pro Plus, which is the separate SKU that you can buy that only includes the client bits and none of the other server-end workloads like Exchange, SharePoint, and Link. The gentleman at the back, he'll put his hand up. So we've said that there are these two requirements that we have, that the machine have, that the user have a user account in the Office 365 tenant and that they have a valid license assigned to them. And once they meet those criteria, we have three ways of that user identifying themselves to the Office 365 service to access any of the services. So whether that's Outlook Web Access, whether that's Outlook Client, Outlook Mobile, whether that's SharePoint Link, or whether that's the ability to activate an Office 365 Pro Plus installation on their own machine, they need to fall into one of these three categories. The three categories are Cloud ID only, DirSync, or ADFS. So the first one is fairly straightforward to understand. You enter the users into the Office 365 tenant, and then the Office 365 service authenticates those users whenever they want to activate those services. Does everyone know what that looks like in reality? A couple of people do, a couple of people don't. Sorry? Nothing. I am going to give everyone the benefit of the doubt and show you. So say I wanted to go and access Outlook, my Outlook web access, and I was in a Cloud ID only environment. And this could be the same if it was SharePoint. This would be the same if we were trying to activate Office. We would get prompted with this login page. Look familiar? It's the Office 365 login page. I would enter my credentials into here. The Office 365 identity service, which is powered by Azure AD, would authenticate the user and give them access to that Office 365 service. Simple, right? So what happens if you have a whole bunch of users and you don't want to sit there either manually typing their names into the admin portal or uploading CSV files every time a new bunch of users comes along? That's when the second scenario comes into play, which is DirSync. There's a session, and I will try and dig up the session code for anyone who's interested on Office 365 identity as a whole. So I won't go into too much detail, but suffice to say, our second DirSync model is where we have a tool that's installed on a domain-joined server, a member server in your environment, and we take usernames, user information, and password hashes, not passwords, but password hashes, and we synchronize them up into the Office 365 Azure AD. So what that allows us to do is still have Office 365 authenticate those users, but not have to manually put those users up into Office 365 ourselves. Oh, it's in there? Do you know what the code is? So OSP 225 is Office 365 Identity Management. Thanks, Zach. And so those are those two scenarios. And if you want more information about identity, I'd suggest you go along to that session because I don't have time to go through it in huge detail. But those are the two simple options. And they're generally pretty good for most of the organizations that will want to deploy Office 365. The reason that they're good most of the time is that, let me say that another way. There are a couple of scenarios where neither of those work, and they are where you'd need to have single sign-on on domain-joined machines that are on the corporate network at the time and logged in with a domain account. So you might say, okay, my end users have already gone to the trouble of logging onto their PC with their domain/user account. And I don't want those users to have to then type in another username and password to activate Office, to get it Outlook Web Access, to get it SharePoint, Link, whatever. So that's the one scenario where neither of these two will work. The second scenario is where you say, whoa. I'm a really security conscious organization. And even though the passwords are not leaving my organization, it's only password hashes that are going up to the Office 365 service, I still feel that that's an unacceptable risk, and I won't let those passwords get synced up into the Office 365 service. So instead, here's what I want to happen. When somebody wants to access an Office 365 service, send that person to me. I will decide if they're cool or not, and then I will send them back to you with a token that says they're cool. And so how does that look? I can show you how that looks by going to outlook.com again, but instead putting on a different suffix, and you'll see the difference. Okay, so now instead of getting the Office 365 sign-in page, I've been presented with an ADFS sign-in page. This ADFS page is being hosted on someone's on-premises infrastructure right next to their Active Directory environment itself. So what happened just then? I tried to go to a URL that said, send me to an Office 365 service, but I'm actually from an organization. I picked Microsoft.com, because Microsoft internally use ADFS. And so send me into Outlook Web Access, and I'm from Microsoft.com. The Office 365 service looks at that URL and straight away says, well, I can't authenticate this person because I haven't been given permission to do that. So instead, I'm going to redirect them in the browser through to their own ADFS infrastructure. So in this case, I'm not on a Microsoft CorpNet domain join machine, so I get prompted with the username and password prompt here. If I was on a domain join machine on the corporate network right next to my domain controller logged in with a domain user, I wouldn't see this logon screen. Instead, I would just flick back to my Outlook Web Access. But because I'm not, I'm presented with this screen here. I can then type in my Microsoft.com Active Directory credentials and be authenticated by the Active Directory Federation service in my company's infrastructure, next to my company's AD, and then I'm sent back to the Office 365 service with a token that says, hey, this guy is who he says he is, we think he's a fairly reasonable bloke, and we think that you should let him in. So instead of the identity taking place inside the Office 365 service, the identity takes place with the organization's Active Directory, and then it's sent back to the Office 365 service already authenticated and ready to access those services. So what does that mean for you if you're looking to deploy Office 365 Pro Plus, or Office as a Service? What it means is that you need to implement one of these three identity platforms before you can give your end users the ability to activate a copy of Office on their machines. Now, if you're doing a larger scale Office 365 rollout, then this is something that you would need to consider anyway, because as we've seen, if you want your users to gain access to any of the other services such as SharePoint or Outlook Web Access or Link or whatever, then you still need to consider all the same identity stuff that you do for the Office client. And if you're only using the Office 365 Pro Plus components and you're not rolling out any of those other workloads, then you still need to consider these identity scenarios because they're the options that you have to actually activate Office against those end users. Yes, was there a question up here? Or just stretching? Okay, we'll go with that. So any questions about identity? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, it's an interesting question. So the gentleman was just saying that this doesn't help automate the entire end-to-end process of user management in Office 365, because even if you use ADFS or DirSync to move those accounts, create those accounts inside the Office 365 as your AD, then you still need to assign licenses to them either manually or using PowerShell script. Did I get that right? Yeah. So I guess the challenge that places is that if you're talking about a service that is charged per user, then how can you automate that without giving the customer the opportunity to either spend that money or not spend that money? And that's where I think the complexity comes into it, because if you are assigning those by hand, then you've definitely said, okay, here is a user that I actually want to give an Office 365 license to, and here is a user that I don't. And if you're doing that by PowerShell, you've essentially still saying the same thing in that, hey, if they're in this particular OU or whatever it is that you've set up, then assign them a E3 or whatever license that they need to work. Having said that, I guess creating a PowerShell script is no more or less accepting that than if it was built into the tool. You're right. But that's how it hangs together at the moment. I don't know the answer to that question. DirSync is certainly a focus for the identity team in Office 365. The previous iteration of DirSync caused a lot of organizations to use ADFS where they might not have needed to, because it didn't support password sync, which meant that any organization that couldn't accept having a different password for email than they had to log onto a computer would have to do ADFS. So obviously you can follow the trend. The investment has been in the DirSync tool to increase its functionality to date. But I don't know any specifics as to whether or not they're going to allow you to assign licenses automatically to a predefined set of users. But what it does mean is that today, a lot more organizations should be able to use DirSync than with the previous iteration. Because those password hashes are synced up, it means that now the only scenarios where you need ADFS is where you either need zero sign-on for domain join logged on machines, or if you have security considerations with having those password hashes sent up into Azure AD. Does that make sense? Or are there more? I'm really keen to hear them if there are. Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense, especially as there's no integration with the Outlook FatBind. You don't get SSO from the FatBind.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that DirSync is making more sense and ADFS is making less sense, which we're arguing the same point. So certainly we're seeing more and more. And that's exciting because DirSync as a process, as you'll see if you go to the identity session, is like a 5-minute job to set up, next, finish, I want this OU, here's my tenant details, click a few things in the portal, finished. ADFS on the other hand is, you know, a bunch of servers, you need at least two servers, one of which needs to be in your DMZ if you have such a thing, and there's a whole process to go through that's 30 steps long to get that implemented, so there is a lot more work that goes into building that. So it's good news that DirSync is now building in functionality and becomes more relevant. So I've just noticed that we are now over time. So please just give me a few seconds to ask you to complete your evals. Normally I chuck in a quick gag here and say that, hey, the tech ed team cancels my flight home if I don't get enough good evals, and so I have to make my way home, and so please go and give me an eval. But in this case, you might have noticed that we actually brought our own plane with us up to tech ed this year, so I can't actually use that gag because I can fly myself home. But regardless, maybe you'll go and put some evals in anyway, and it looks like there's some great prizes going on if you do, such as some awesome mice. Let me remind you once again, that we have our Office 365 Ultimate Flight Experience going on all week, so we've got another draw at 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. tomorrow, and then another draw at 11 a.m. on Friday. And I'd encourage you to go down to the Microsoft Productivity Showcase and sign up to win that. And I'm going to head back to the productivity showcase after I get out of here. So if there's anything that I can go into more detail with you about, then please come and find me there. Or I'll be here for 5 or 10 minutes as well. And thanks so much for your time. You've been a fantastic audience, and I really appreciate your attention. Thanks, guys.